Donald Trump is, at this point, I think unquestionably, the most successful loser in the history of planet Earth.
Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. When Donald Trump won re-election to the presidency, the first person I wanted to talk to was Michael Cruz. Michael and his family live in Davidson, North Carolina, and he's a graduate of Davidson College. He's a longtime friend. Michael spent years in and around Trump's first term writing stories for Politico about Trump's history and psychology. He has also profiled Trump's incoming chief of staff, Susie Wiles. But he spent much of last year reporting and writing a story about one American family and their political divide that speaks to the changing way we talk to each other or don't talk to each other in this country. So we talk about that and what to expect from Trump's second term and how to approach that great American divide as a journalist and as a citizen too. Here's our conversation. Michael Cruz, I want to start with this extraordinary story that you wrote and that was published just a few days before the election about the Johnson family. Well, you know what? I just want you to describe it. Can you just tell listeners who maybe didn't read it kind of what that story was about and how long you had been trying to tell it?
Sure. It's a story about two brothers named Ted and Fred Johnson. Ted lives in New Hampshire and voted for Trump. Fred lives in Louisville, Kentucky and voted for Kamala Harris. So they are, in some sense, this like traditional, now unfortunately traditional, story of a family riven by politics, but also very much brother against brother, this kind of archetypal tale. But what I found in the course of, really over the course of a year, getting to know them, visiting with them in New Hampshire, in Louisville, visiting with their mother multiple times in Centralia, Illinois, where they grew up, this divide that exists between them goes much, much deeper than politics, in some sense, their entire lives. And so the story to me became a story of not just a political divide that is so elemental in understanding our country today, but kind of deeper sources of our political divide. So in trying to get to know Ted and Fred and Peggy, their mother, trying to get to know what made the Johnsons this way, I'm trying to understand what made us, this country, this way.
Ted and Fred, at the time you wrote the story, had not talked to each other for a long time. After the election, has that changed?
They've not talked to each other. They continue, both of them, to talk to me. I text with Ted and Fred, not daily, but almost daily still since the story ran, but they don't talk to each other. And one of the interesting things over the course of the year reporting this piece is this idea that that got more and more prominent to me. They're talking to me as much as they are because they don't talk to each other. They have so much to say about how they feel and why they feel these ways. And so much really to say to each other, but they can't. Fred wants very much to talk to Ted. Ted wants less to talk to Fred. But there's a part of both of them that wants to talk to each other and wants to figure out a way to repair this rift, but they can't. At least they haven't yet. And so they talk to me. And even after the story, they continue, both of them, to talk to me. It was a story for me unlike really any other story I've done in now, what, a quarter century of doing this work for a living. The way I became, first kind of uncomfortably, but then more and more okay with it, an intermediary, almost a translator between the two of them. And frankly, it's made me think about different ways, a slightly altered way to approach my work to come as we head into the next four or more years.
A chicken and egg question. Do you think these two brothers split because of their politics? Or do you think their politics is a reflection of their rift?
I think the rift has almost nothing to do with politics. They've settled into their respective corners in this political context because that's what we do now as a country. The seeds of the rift, though, are family trauma, multi-generational trauma, arguments over money, the perceptions of self, everything that exists in every family to some extent. Now, though, we find ourselves, we allow ourselves to be pushed into these corners. It's easier for Ted and Fred, and for all the Teds and Freds, I think, at this point, to say, I'm for Trump, or I'm against Trump, or for anything and against anything in this perma-conflict of our political moment, when in reality, it's so much more. I loved how the story turned out, actually, in some ways, because it did, I think, in some unusual way, allow me, working for Politico, to tell a story that is, yes, about politics, but it's not first and foremost about politics, which I think is how we need to understand where we've gotten politically in this country, or a part of how we should try to understand it.
One thing that struck me is reading the story again, and feel free to tell me if I'm off base here. I felt like Fred, who voted for Kamala Harris, is sort of looking for redemption. And Ted, who voted for Trump, is sort of looking for attention. Does that ring true to you, and does that say anything larger about where people align themselves?
That's interesting. I think Fred, more than redemption, is looking for some kind of peace. I think Ted wants to be seen. Maybe that's a different way of saying wants attention. Ted wants to be seen. Ted wants to be respected. Ted feels disrespected. He's long felt disrespected, but that's partly a function of the fact that he feels like he was always in the shadow of Fred, who is the bigger brother, the older brother by three some years. You know, something Ted told me and that I put in the story is, you know, they still see me as Teddy. That's like a very fundamental way to say what has almost become a cliche at this point. You know, there's a certain kind of Trump voter that feels left behind, that feels laughed at, disrespected. You know, the Freds in the cities, and we don't typically think of Louisville as like a, you know, coastal city, but it really has become just sort of cities against everywhere. Whether the city is in Kentucky or Oklahoma or is San Francisco or New York, it's just a city, right? Like the cities are looking down at me. To me, that comes down to, you know, they still see me as Teddy.
So I want to get, you know, move on to Trump himself. You probably studied him for several years, as much or more as anybody. So I'm wondering if you recall a moment for him that sort of resonates with this particular moment, meaning he lost at some point and then he made a comeback. And I'm wondering if you can think of other moments in his life that those sort of things have happened and how he acted once he had gotten back on top, basically.
Let me say something before I answer that question. It is my intention, my hope, that I do not write about Donald Trump himself in the coming 4 years anywhere close to the way I did the first 4 years he was president and the 2 years before that when he started running. I think for me, and I think for all of us in some sense, my colleagues in journalism and competitors in journalism, and also all of us as a country, as a citizenry, need to find a way to focus in some strange sense a little bit less on him. I find myself wanting to shift from who is he to who are we. I find myself wanting to not think about as much what makes him tick and think far more about why we, and now a majority popular vote, voted for him again. That is much more interesting and feels much more useful to me at this point. But to answer your question more directly, Donald Trump is, at this point, I think unquestionably, the most successful loser in the history of planet Earth. He's a huge fan of comebacks. He literally wrote a book, or a ghostwriter did, called The Art of the Comeback. That's a function of this incredible knack and skill he has had his entire life, well before he got into electoral politics, to lose and yet win, to turn setbacks into successes. Not quite sure when this story ran, but really, really early on, maybe right after he became president the first time, I think the headline of this piece that I wrote was something like How Trump Succeeds When He Fails, or something along those lines. He's a man who is no stranger to bankruptcy laws, no stranger to just eye-watering amounts of debt that would have been fatal to any other person and were not to him for lots of reasons. Yes, like built-in advantages, lots of money from dad, but also a developed sense of how to leverage weakness and turn it into strength, make others around him a little bit complicit. Like, you, the banks, this is your problem too. And fast forward, not to get stuck in the weeds, to his political rise. I mean, one of the things he's done, there's lots of ways to look at Trump and interpret Trump, of course, but one of the things he was able to do in his, essentially at this point, complete takeover of the Republican Party is make other Republicans in some sense complicit. I'm your problem now too. You need the new base I've created. You've said this about me and now you can't say that about me. All versions of the same skill set, if that's the right way to put it. And a certain just amount of audacity to not go away, to refuse to accept a defeat, I mean, clearly, as we've seen the last handful of years, but also just sticking around. I'm not leaving. I'm not going back to Mar-a-Lago. I'm not just going to golf. I'm going to declare my candidacy in late 2022, and it's in some very real way going to make it harder for you and you and you and you to prosecute me. It's just an intuitive understanding of how to survive situations, self-created situations, by the way, that would long ago have stopped literally any other person.
Back in the spring, you wrote a story about Susie Wiles, who just got named in the last day or two as Trump's chief of staff. The story you wrote was almost still true now, that she's somebody that nobody knows much about, but holds an extremely powerful place in Trump world. She sounds like she kind of ran his campaign in many ways. In the story, you quote a political operative in Florida saying, "She is an expert in unstable, dysfunctional, famous men." Is that something that should comfort America or terrify us?
Both. Up to you. We'll see. I will say that is the most common question I got you know, in a series of text messages in the immediate wake of the announcement that she would be chief of staff. First of all, the announcement that she would be his chief of staff was, you know, in a way, not news, at least not to me. Only in the most technical sense was it news. I mean, that was hers to say no to. And of course, she did not say no to it. Max Stepanovich, who is the Republican operative, or at this point, former Republican operative, who said that to me in that story, said it because Susie's father was Pat Summerall, the famous sports announcer, before that semi-famous professional football player for, among other teams, the New York Giants. Also was an alcoholic, was a philanderer, was by his own admission at times and at very important times in Susie's life as a child and as a young adult, an absent father. So Susie had to figure out a way through the course of her life to manage that situation, make the best of difficult moments, how to navigate around that, how to maintain a relationship with her father, and ultimately how to guide her father to a, or help guide her father to a better place. By the end of his life, he was sober, and they had, from what he said, he's dead now, but what he has said, what he said before, what he wrote, and what certainly Susie said to me and has said to others for that matter, you know, got to a place of reconciliation toward the end of his life. And so in that sense, I suppose there's something for those so inclined to find some solace. She's a calming presence. She's a savvy operator. I mean, she can turn a knife too. She's a political combatant. But I think on the whole, and this is not really for me to say, and again, TBD, but on the whole, it strikes me as a net positive, if that's the way to put it, that Susie will, for the time being, continue to play the role she has played in the Trump orbit since early 2021, which is to say, the most trusted, respected, and listened to advisor, without question. In my estimation, for whatever that's worth, she's a smart and thoughtful person. Lots of people are free to disagree with decisions she's made and do. Lots of people can see her as an aider and abettor to a malevolent force and do. But she is also a smart and thoughtful person.
That gets to, I guess, a larger question, which is, what's our confidence level that there are guardrails, whether in the actual human version or in the structures of our government and society, to keep Trump from doing whatever it is on a given day he decides to do?
So I've been thinking a lot about this over the last week plus. I've been talking to a lot of people to try to help me think through this and having conversations with people who are also doing this kind of thinking, Republicans, Democrats, academics, etc. Guardrails still exist. We are a government of checks and balances, but I also think one of the things, in some composite way, one of the things I've taken away from the conversations I've had over the last week or so, is that ultimately the guardrails are us. They're not this branch of government or that branch. They're not the courts. I mean, they are to some extent, but ultimately, and more importantly, the guardrails are us. What do we want? What are we willing to put up with? What are we willing to do or say when we're not willing to put up with X, Y, or Z? And when I say we, I mean very literally you individually. What can I do to stop something we don't want to happen. I don't know what those things are yet. I think perhaps some of us are about to find out. But one of the more interesting pieces of the interesting conversations I feel like I've been having of late, somebody brought up the notion of Martin Luther King pre-Montgomery bus boycott. He was uncomfortable with the role that was starting to happen around him, or what people were wanting him to do then. But before that, nobody knows really who Martin Luther King is, or certainly he's not a person for whom we have a holiday, right? And any one of us could be that if presented with such an opportunity. You don't know. We don't know the names of the people we don't know, because we don't know what they might be called to do or what they might be moved to do.
Rosa Parks wasn't Rosa Parks until she got tired of moving on the bus.
Correct. And what's interesting to me to think about is, you know, because I work at Politico, I've been conditioned to think in the form of elected officials or would-be elected officials or political professionals, politics adjacent professionals. And actually, maybe I need to sort of widen my field of view for what might be on the way. It's not just a mayor of a blue city and a red state, of which there are many, who's grappling right now with how best to respond to this or that that might happen. What can I do? If I do that, what will the consequence be? If I don't do that, what will the consequence be? I mean, there are mayors and elected officials certainly wrestling with this right now, with, you know, internally and externally, conversations with people like me, right? But also, that goes for everybody, right? There might be some things that a non-mayor can do that a mayor kind of can't. These are the kinds of things that I'm like very interested in watching. And how am I trying to answer that question for myself? Kind of gets back to Ted and Fred a little bit. I need to understand better, even more than I already have tried in the last decade. I need to understand better why more and more people, more and more different kinds of people in different kinds of places, not just rural areas, not just suburbs, cities now more and more, not just white people, not just college educated people, so many different kinds of people, almost all kinds of people moved right, moved more toward Trump. I need to understand more about that. And what that means is continuing and even ramping up my efforts to talk to Freds and Teds. I need to talk to not fewer Teds and Freds. I need to talk to more Teds and Freds. And I need to talk to more Teds and Freds in the hope that, and maybe even to try to help move us in a direction where more Teds are talking to more Freds. Like, I want Ted and Fred to talk, but I want Teds and Freds to talk more in more places about more things more often. Because I find myself thinking, and this is just an extension of what I've felt for years at this point, if we don't solve that problem, as far as I'm concerned, we're in a bit of a death spiral as a functioning country.
When we come back, Michael Cruz talks about his goal as a political writer.
I want to have better, deeper, realer conversations with people.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Before we get back to this episode, I wanted to ask for a little help with something. If you enjoy Southbound, please give us a good rating and write us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast provider you have that allows such things. The more reviews and better ratings we get, the better chance there is that other listeners can find us. But to be honest, I'd just as soon you tell people about Southbound through good old word of mouth. If you could recommend it to just one person you know, somebody you might think would enjoy interesting conversations about the South, I'd be deeply grateful. If you have any thoughts about the show, guests to recommend, or anything that you think might make Southbound better, you can email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. Thanks so much for giving us a little bit of your time. And now, back to my conversation with Michael Cruz. Obviously, you're really good at getting people to talk to you. But I do wonder, in these last 4, 8 years or whatever, has that become harder? Politico, although it's, you know, it's a website, it's kind of a, it's not old traditional media by any sense, but it does a lot of traditional media things. And I wonder whether with either professional politician types or just people on the street say to you these days, you don't matter anymore.
So there's a difference between the media doesn't matter, Politico doesn't matter, and I don't matter, right? And I'm thinking here of something a former colleague of mine at the St. Petersburg Times in Florida, Lane DeGregory, used to say. She would say, the first time I call somebody or meet somebody, I'm Lane DeGregory from the St. Pete Times. The second time, I'm Lane DeGregory. The third time, I'm just Lane. And that's how I try to operate, just sort of organically. I don't think about that every time I meet somebody, but, and it's not even a first, second, or third time. It's within a conversation. I introduce myself as Michael Cruz from Politico. At some point in that conversation, or in a relationship, if it leads to that, and as quickly as possible, I want to just be Michael. I don't want them to think about Politico. And not in some devious way. I want them to think they are having a conversation with another human being, because they are. I'm having a conversation with a human being. They're having a conversation with a human being. We're talking about stuff. I'm not conducting an interview. I'm not harvesting a quote. I'm not trying to fill a space in a story I've already written. I'm trying to have a conversation to learn about how this person thinks, how this person got to this place. And I'm doing that in a as open-hearted, as curious, as empathetic a way as possible. And to do that, I need to be Michael and not Michael Cruz from Politico. And so to answer your question, has that gotten harder in the decade I've been at Politico or the 25 years I've been doing this? No, not for me, at least, just speaking for myself. If anything, it's gotten a little bit, not easier, but a little bit more natural. It's just how I interact with people in a professional way, but there's not such a distinction between the professional and the personal, I think, for me, if I'm doing what I need to do professionally.
Do you worry sometimes that you're too good at it? And here's why I ask. Because in that story about the Johnson brothers, toward the end, you're talking to their mother, Peggy. And Peggy, it's I don't remember what she's just revealed to you, but some core thing about her family and their relationships. And she goes to you and she says, I wish I hadn't told you all this.
Yeah, she said she was ashamed that she had told me all of this, which is a hell of a thing to say to somebody, especially to a reporter. That's an interesting question. I mean, how am I too good at, am I too good at getting the Peggies to tell me things like that, like those things? What does that even, what does that even mean? What does it look like? I want to have real conversations with real people, because I want to have a fighting shot at being able to tell real stories. So I don't know what too good would mean. I want to get in some ways with everybody to the place, to that place, to the place I found myself with Peggy and that Peggy found herself with me. I want to have better, deeper, realer conversations with people, both personally, but also professionally. Like I have a professional obligation to try to get there. So I don't know. Do you think, what does that mean? Do you like, what does it mean to be, well, first of all, it sounds incredibly self-serving, but what would the downside of being quote too good at that be?
Here's the way I think about it sometimes. There's that thing in fiction they talk about, or in any storytelling, that idea of suspension of disbelief, where for a moment you forget you're reading a story and you're part of it. I think there's a version of that that can happen when a really good reporter is talking to somebody and they build a relationship together, and that person they're talking to forgets that they're talking to this person not as a friend or as just a kind ear, but as somebody who is going to publish this story and 2 million people are going to see it in a week. I think that's great for us as reporters to be able to get people to forget for a moment why this conversation is happening. But I do also wonder whether it's always good, or if it matters if it's good to the people who are talking to us. I guess let me ask it this way. Do you have any idea how Picky felt once the story came out?
Let me answer that by starting to say this. I think this is a fair line of thought. And the way and there is no handbook. There's no, I didn't go to journalism school, but there is no class in journalism school, at least that I know of, where there's like an actual handbook that says this is exactly what you should do in this kind of situation. So it's an ethical question that, in some sense you have to figure out on your own with, the help of people you respect in the business, with your editor, etc. The way I did it, literally, with Ted and Fred and Peggy at various points along the way in the better part of a year that I took to get to know them, this is the way how I'd remind them that, like, I'm not here to be your friend. And I'm also not, I would say, I'm not a family therapist. I'm just a reporter. I'm not here to make you talk again. If that happens, so be it. And if you think that will help, terrific. I'm not going to stand in the way, but I'm here because I'm working on this story, because I think this story is important. I think this story will resonate with a lot of people. Things along those lines. And so I never, yes, there are some moments where, to use your phrase, like there's a sort of suspension of disbelief where, there is a certain amount of forgetting that's going on. But in those situations, I'd always find a way to be like, offer a reminder that, like, here's who I am and here's what I'm doing. Now, the lines get a little fuzzier. I don't want to do that too much. I'm just like, hey, here's my notebook. The recorder's running. Stop having this interesting conversation with me. But I want to insert into that conversation like a restating of the terms of engagement, of the literal reason I am here with you right now, right? I haven't talked to Peggy. I understand that Peggy sort of took it in and has read the story. No issues necessarily. I haven't heard from Peggy, but it is my intention probably to give Peggy a call here at some point soon, just to get a better sense for me and not just from her sons about how she's feeling about it. But I also want to add, the reason I think, or I know, Peggy talked to me at all, let alone the way she did, which was she was on board in some similar way to Fred, because she thought, because she wants her sons to talk again. And if even one of them thinks this might help them talk again. And maybe Ted kind of subconsciously thinks maybe this process will help them talk again. Peggy was there for that because she too wants, as any mother would, I think, her sons to talk again. So to whatever extent this story at some point might lead to that, I think she sees her participation in the story and the story itself at the very least slightly more positive than negative.
So this kind of comes back to what you were saying earlier on, and maybe we'll just kind of close the conversation here, about you thinking about doing stories that get people talking to each other who hadn't been in the past, or who maybe politics or circumstances or whatever have split them in some way, and maybe something you can do can bring them back together. That's also not kind of a traditional journalistic role. You know, we're like, you know, the idea for so many years is we stand back and watch it happen and sort of report on the car crash after it's happened instead of trying to keep the car crashes from happening in some way. So how do you see your role here? What do you see that you think you could be able to do? What kinds of stories, and not just you, but us, you know, reporters, and maybe just people on the street who have neighbors who they don't know how to talk to for whatever reason. What are the ways from that stance of detachment to maybe getting your hands in there a little more? What can you do and still feel good about being a journalist, being a reporter, all those sorts of things? That's a long-winded question, and I'm sorry.
It's a hard thing to articulate, and I'm still trying to gather my own thoughts. And the effort is not overt. I'm not going in there to a place where I'm reporting, where I see a story in a way in which my number one goal is to make, you know, this person on the political right talk more to this person on the political left. It's like slightly more subtle than that. I just want to think more consciously as I report, and therefore as I write, about stories that include characters or situations that for some readers open a space in which they can feel just a little bit more of a sense of understanding, less antipathy or even at this point contempt for somebody who is very different, who sits in a very different place on the political spectrum. And I almost want to uncouple it from even that context. It's hard to articulate, but to the extent that I can do this with a story, I want to create a little bit of space between a person in the pixels of Politico and what seems to be their orientation on the political spectrum. I want to uncouple that. This is just a person who exists, yes, in this political context, but exists and sits there because of all these other reasons. And if you sit and think with all those other reasons, a person who's very, very different politically, who votes completely differently, would at least find some commonality, some sharedness, just you know, add a few empathy points. And I know this sounds, I mean, you know, in its worst version, it sounds kind of woo-woo or self-indulgent, but this is where I find my head at right now. This is what I need to, it doesn't have to exist in the text of a story, and I don't think it will, but consciously I'm bringing, I think, that altered or slightly altered mindset to the work. in the hope that down the road, even in some small way for some small group of people or more, it alleviates this divide that exists. And maybe it's not possible. But if it's not possible, and if this divide is just going to continue to be this and continue to get worse, that's a wrap, everybody. The only question is when and how we literally split apart as a country.
Don't you think somebody read that Ted and Fred story and called their brother and said, I don't want to be like this. Let's have a conversation. Don't you feel like that's part of all the things that how people reacted to that story? Somebody called their brother.
I hope so. I don't know what this says, but nobody landed in my inbox saying precisely that. But certainly I got some messages that suggested it made some people think about that. Think about, you know, a brother or a cousin or a sister or a parent that they no longer talk to because of, you know, this set of reasons. And, you know, my goal was to write a compelling true story, as it always is. But I also hope that, you know, some byproduct of that story, and hopefully it will have a long tail because of this. Hopefully people will find their way to that story in whatever way. And it will continue to at least like put that possibility into the air.
How do we even talk to each other now? As Michael Cruz says, that's not just a job for journalists. It's a job for you and me as citizens of a country we still want to believe in. The gap between the left and right is the widest it's been in our lifetimes. But there is still common ground. It will just take work to find it and to hold on to it when we do. I'm saying these words the week before Thanksgiving, when there will be a lot of awkward moments around the dinner tables of America. It might be tempting to lash out, to vent your anger at a family member who votes on the other side. That's understandable. But chances are that person is also someone you care about, maybe even someone you love. There's a reason you felt that way about them too. So maybe start from there instead of starting from the conflict. It is likely to be a difficult time ahead, but it is still within us to make it less so. And as Michael Cruz says, if we keep not talking to each other, if we keep driving ourselves further apart, we're sunk. A big part of our job as Americans over these next 4 years and beyond is to keep talking and to stay afloat. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our editors are Lisa Worf and Jen Lang. Our main theme music comes from Joshua Lee Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Subscribe for free to get each new episode sent to you when it's ready. You can also find Southbound on our website. Just go to wfae.org/podcast/southbound. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.